Thank you, Johan, and thanks to all of you for taking the time to come and share an evening with me. Johan has made a good attempt to exaggerate and to flatter. Good attempt, but not there yet. The less the better. I was really thrilled when I was asked to come and talk to you. I was thrilled because I think one of the unfortunate realities of our country is that we don't do real conversations as a country. We talk about things, but we don't converse in a way that gets us to the next level. And when we do converse, we tend to stay within our own little enclaves and wonder what's happening with people outside of our own enclaves. So we end up with these misconceptions about who we are as a people and what is really possible in this beautiful country of ours. So tonight, I'm going to answer Johan's question to me, which I thought was cheeky. And the question is, what if God ran our country? Rather cheeky. So my simple answer is, I have very good news for you. God is running this country. And I say this with great confidence. It's simply a question of us being aware that God is here. His loving presence is always with us. We only need to listen more carefully to his gentle encouragement and to trust him and trust our inner voices, because our inner voices are the spirits. And that spirit was put there by our Creator. So if you trust that, and trust the encouragement of God, then you really start feeling that God is in charge. It is when we become closer and more attuned to what God's purposes are for us and for this beautiful, beloved country of ours, that we can be truly free to serve God through serving others who are made in his image. Imagine what kind of country ours would become if that became the starting point of every day when you wake up in the morning to say, God, thank you for the beautiful night. Now we're going to work today. What's on the agenda? And how can I be strengthened enough to be able to engage in the duties of this day, celebrate the people I encounter today? Imagine how we would approach our life choices as individuals, as families, as communities, and workplace participants and citizens of this wonderful country of ours, if that was our starting point. Johan also asked me to talk about how my faith influenced my politics. The short answer is, if I had followed the faith that I had been brought up with, I wouldn't be here. I had to discard that and embrace a deeper connection with God, uncolored by the injustices of my time as a young person. And so my politics are the result of a consciousness-raising process that we as young students started in 1968 at the University of Natal, listen to it, non-European section. This country, is it in Europe? How can you name a section of a university non-European? As if we are living in Europe. I had grown up in Kranspoort on the foot of the Soutpansberg Mountain in Limpopo. it was a rural village with a Dutch Reform minister, Dominee, Meneer Lucas van der Merwe, who was as tough as all boot leather, racist, and totally unconscious of God's purposes for him. In the name of being a Dominee, he was really an unadulterated human rights abuser. And my parents, who were teachers at this little mission, grew up and learned to avoid attracting attention. As public servants, they kept their head down and brought us up, but gave us very good education. And so we never had political discussions at home. Even when my sister was expelled from Emerentia High School in 1961 because they refused to celebrate the birth of the Republic of South Africa then, it was never discussed. I just saw my sister being back from school and I didn't know what happened. So I went to the University of Natal totally green. As they say. I knew something was wrong in the country, but I didn't know what it was. How can a man be as crude as this Van America? How can? That's where the questions are. But it is when we realize that the so-called multiracial politics of students of the day under the National Union of South African Students, that the white students who were our fellow members of NUSAS, when it came to having conferences, like you were talking about having a workshop, we would be asked to go and sleep in a church and they'll sleep in the residence at Rhodes University. That's when we realized that you can't actually expect someone who's benefiting from a system to seriously lead the charge, changing that system. It's not reasonable. So we realized that freedom starts from within. We acknowledge that we were also partly responsible for the persistence of racism by accepting the premises that said that there is something superior about the white skin and something inferior about the black skin. We realize that the most potent weapon that an oppressor can have in their hand is the mind of the oppressed. And at that time, we didn't know, but later on, as I was writing and exploring, I came across a man called John Henry Clark, an African-American historian, who wrote in the late 60s and about how white racist oppression works globally, not just in South Africa. And this is what he said. To control a people, you must first control what they think about themselves and how they regard their history and their culture. And when your conqueror makes you ashamed of your culture and your history, he needs no prison walls, no chains to hold you. So we decided it's our job to free our mind. And we started from the beginning by naming ourselves. At that time, we used to call knee blankets. We said, no, we are black and we are proud and that's who we are. We are not going to be measured by what somebody else says. And it was at that point that the invisible bond fell off our arms and knees. And psychological freedom is the prerequisite to physical and material freedom. Black people need to free themselves from white racism and the resultant inferiority complex. Equally, white people need to free themselves from a superiority complex that makes them blind to the legacy of privilege and makes them believe that they are where they are because they worked harder or they're smarter or somehow they have a work ethic that's different from the rest of us. In addition, as a woman, I also say to my fellow women, we need to free ourselves from the yoke of male dominance that undermines the contributions of women to society. Because God created us male and female. But each one of us has within us a feminine and a masculine. It's just a question of what balance. And that feminine is highly important in terms of the connectedness of human beings, the ability to do stuff, which only women can do in the way they do it. Men need to be free also, because men are oppressed by this male dominance, which requires an alpha male to rule the roost. It's really oppressive. And because you're oppressed by this alpha male, you oppress those who are weaker than you. Then it's a cycle of oppression and conflict. And that's why we have this terrible gender-based violence in our homes, in our communities, in our workplaces, and everywhere. And indeed, we have violence in the world today where we have people who are prepared to kill for the sake of making their point. Freeing the mind entails embracing oneself as God's child, created in His image. One's culture becomes a source of pride and a resource for the development of a strong personal identity. At the same time, reverence for God's creation opens the way to celebrate the beauty of the diversity of God's people. Since 1968, my life has been shaped by a deep consciousness of myself as a proud black woman with a rich African heritage. The personal, the professional, and the political are governed by the same harmonious value system. And that very system is called Ubuntu. We have it in our constitution, but it's a name, a word. Ubuntu for me is the embodiment of African wisdom that says, you can't be human all on your own. To be human, you must be affirmed by other human beings, and you in turn must do that. And when we don't do that, we violate our own humanity. Every religion is predicated on this Ubuntu. When the gospel says, love one another and love your God and love one another as you love yourself, it's the same principle. Because when you love your God, you love God's creatures, and you are one of those. So what can the church do to help South Africa? The church can only help South Africa by helping itself to become the true body of Christ. The church has to reimagine itself away from its past and present complicities with acts of human indignity, injustices, and inequities. Churches have become big business in South Africa. That clearly cannot be what the Lord had in mind when He said, we are the body of Christ. The church has a major role to play to become a safe space for us as a society to acknowledge that we are all wounded by the legacy and the continuing injustices in our society. Our wounds undermine our capacity to be united in our diversity, as we say in our constitution. It must start with each one of us looking inside, inward. Why do we still have separate churches for white people and black people, for rich and poor? Why are we continuing to do the proverbial walking around to avoid the sites of carnage from socioeconomic injustices in this country? We need an emotional settlement process within the church. In 1994, we had a political settlement. We were all very excited by it. But a political settlement without the emotional settlement is hollow. The church needs to acknowledge its role in supporting justices of the past and continuing to do so today. It also needs to accept that it benefited from those injustices. Engaging in emotional settlement processes would put us in a state of mind that opens the way to mutual understanding and affirmation of our need for individual and collective healing. Healing cannot be sustained unless there is a holistic process that involves conversations at all levels of society. The home, some of our dinner tables have toxic conversations. The workplaces where we need to be working together are not conducive because there is mistrust and bad feelings. The school environments where young minds and souls are supposed to be nurtured, you hear horror stories about teachers sexually abusing kids. You must be sick to do that. Only six societies have teachers who continue to teach with that sort of approach to life. We need to also address the toxic lifestyles and leadership styles within these mega churches and even the small churches. I'm an Anglican. There is much in the Anglican church that needs to be healed. Because I go to St. George's Cathedral, I have everything there, you know, high church and all. But you go to Langa, they hardly have a candle to celebrate Mass. It can't be. The church cannot minister to society when it is not ministering to itself. Now, what's the future? I believe we need, as South Africans, to reimagine this beautiful country of ours. That dream which we had in 1994, we need to redream it. Redream it now with the benefit of what we didn't do right in the last 22 years. And commit to rebuilding this country in the image of that excitement of 1994. And in the preamble of our constitution, we talk about Ubuntu as the hallmark of what our country is supposed to look like. So if you were to successfully reimagine our country and start rebuilding, what would we have in our mind's eye? One, I believe we would have an energized 1994 dream. We don't have to change the preamble of our constitution. We just have to make it come alive. Second, we would have an emotional settlement so that we can have those tough conversations that we haven't had in this country. The TRC showed us the way. But we kind of, you know how you skim, instead of doing real proper vacuum cleaning and what do they call it? Spring cleaning in at home. No, we just clean the front part of the house. The rest is full of fleas and bed bugs and the rest. We need to get back there and do the work. Because when we have this emotional settlement, and I can't tell you how many people say to me, but, you know, I was a child when apartheid happened, so how can I be held responsible for it? No one is saying we are holding you responsible. We are saying acknowledge the fact that where you sit, you are there in part because the system that we have in this country has cities like this one, Tshwane, which is still an apartheid city. The poorer you are, the further away from the resources of the city. You come to Cape Town, my beloved Cape Town, where I live, it's scandalous because you see where I live in Kems Bay and you go to Khayelitsha. You tell me, how can you call it one city for all? It's not one city for all. And so we pretend like these things are not happening. I can tell you about Johannesburg, Alexander and Sandton. We know that. So we need to acknowledge that stuff happened, which shouldn't have happened. We don't have to take personal responsibility, but we have to take collective responsibility for what happened. And we must commit as a people to work together, black and white, young and old, poor and rich, to put right what went wrong. And that emotional settlement will connect us in the way we are not yet connected. We still think of ourselves, Afrikaner, Xhosa, Pedi. You know, you go to America, you go to Germany. People are Germans. They don't say, I'm German this and that's that. Here, we haven't yet taken ownership of being South African, finished and clear. We are not. Because we haven't done the work that knits us together. And I'll come back during question time to use the example of Germany, because Germany has had multiple traumas that it inflicted on the world and on itself, but then they took very active steps after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 to unite Germany. Not as poor East Germany and rich West Germany, as Germany. And for that, every German has to contribute a solidarity tax. It's still being paid today. You can't actually build a society. And Helmut Kohl was not a radical, knew that. And he persuaded the Germans to really come to terms with having to do that. And once we have done that, then we will have a country. I have a 7-year-old grandson. I want to leave this country to him with a clear conscience that it's a country that I am proud to leave to him. Right now, I'm not sure that I want him to inherit what we have. But for that, I believe that the church has, as a tool, not just the gospel, not just the Torah or all the other holy books, but the church has the wisdom of Africa, which we embedded in our constitution, Ubuntu. What does it mean? It means that we are providing through Ubuntu a mutually acceptable healing situation. Where, you know, as somebody who believes in that, you have no choice but to forgive someone who says, I am sorry. There is no escape in the Ubuntu configuration. You can't say, yeah, you hurt me and I'm not going to forgive you. Because if I don't forgive you, I cannot be whole. We need to forgive one another so that we can be whole as a people. And the Ubuntu framework also helps us to reimagine ours as a society where unity in diversity takes on a reality that will not just be celebrated as a brand, but will govern our every engagement. So our schools will be modeling that. Our workplaces will model that. Look at the level of productivity in this country. Our economy has ground to a halt. And we're not going to get this economy going in a sustainable way unless we unleash the energies of every South African. I am not one who believes that we should hand over or hand out grants to people. I think we need to have a safety net for all those who are indigenous. But we have 4 million young people with energy who are loitering in the streets because we have failed them through our school system. We have failed them through our residential places. We have failed them through our CETA system of sectoral training, which is not working. And yet we look the other way and continue to wonder why the economy is not growing. Can unleash that energy. And if we do this, we will be able to connect with this primary identity as South African citizens of this beloved country. And so I believe that emotional settlement conversations, which the church is best suited to conduct, makes us much more self-assured as South Africans. Our secondary identities as Afrikaners, as Greeks, as Sotho's, as are under no threat. They just make the bouquet much nicer, different colors, different shapes. We need to reimagine a society that lives the gospel injunction of loving one another and serving God through serving others. We need to reimagine the church as a model of a just society where all citizens feel they belong and they can contribute to shared prosperity. I want to end with what is my prayer for South Africa. And I ask you to close your eyes. God, open our eyes to your blessings. Our beautiful country, the diversity of his people, and the wealth you bestowed on us. Help us to acknowledge our woundedness and to trust in your unending mercies to heal us. Give us the courage to reach across our divide, to ask for and to receive forgiveness. Grant that we may commit to live and work to your praise and glory. Amen.
Okay, is this one working? All right, so I'm gonna ask Dr. Rampele a couple of questions, and then we can again open the floor for questions from the floor. I think one of the first questions, Doctor, that I'm thinking about or that came up is how, given what you saw in apartheid, given that you saw, you spoke about Van der Merwe and all sorts of other atrocities, your partner was brutally killed by the regime. How did you manage to forgive after that? How do you manage to forgive a guy who looks like me, speaks bad English like me in my Afrikaans accent that represented the apartheid regime? I'm humbled and also curious how that is possible.
First of all, as I said, I believe in the age-old African wisdom of Ubuntu. By forgiving, I'm doing myself a favor. I'm freeing myself from the burden of hatred, of resentment. And it's sappy. It saps your energy. But when you recognize that the person who wronged you did so because they are themselves wounded. Let's take Van der Merwe. He was a miserable man who was a very angry man. Although he had this facade of a privileged white person, he was not happy because he was not educated. He was, So a society which is unjust, even for those who are purportedly benefiting. The same thing with male dominance. You can think you are the male that rules the roost. You are unhappy, my friend, because if you really believe in equality of human dignity and you live with your wife, your family, in loving, mutually supportive, you are so much more happy, so much more productive. And so I don't believe that I forgive because I'm a superior being. I'm just perhaps someone who's very conscious that I cannot but forgive. Because if I don't forgive, I can never be the person God created me to be. So for me, it's not about forgiving as a charity. Forgiving is part of that human engagement that God, that's God's purpose. He created us so that we can live that life. He knows we are frail beings. We make mistakes. But he doesn't condemn us forever. He's the God who forgives us 77 times, 77 times forever. So who am I to think that I can strut around and say you are too polluted for me to forgive? Also, I'm very conscious that in some ways the Afrikaners became the harsh apartheid engineers that they are because they were oppressed by the English. But that's no excuse. It's like the Jews having been oppressed by the Germans and the rest of the world to oppress the Palestinians because they haven't asked the fundamental question. How do we transcend the ugly divide and reach across these chasms
I recently had a quote, and it's become my favorite quote for the week, that anger that is not transformed is transferred. And that seems to be the case with the Afrikaner. It seems to be the case with the Jews. So how would you say, how do you transform that kind of anger?
Well, I think the first step is not to be angry at the angry person, but to help them. That's why the church has got this responsibility. Help them to realize that anger is like guilt. They are negative emotions that don't actually take you forward. They always take you back. Whereas forgiveness, and you've got to forgive yourself. Because why people are angry is because they are thinking about, yeah, if it were not for so-and-so, I would be this, that. Excuse me, you are not that. Now, what are you going to do about where you are and move forward? Okay? And so, it's really about the need for us in very supportive circles to help one another. That's why it's important. These conversations must be at home, must be in the workplace, must be in the school environment, must be wherever friends are meet, so you can create mutually supportive networks. Because this work is not an event. This is a process of healing, which is a journey. Mm-hmm.
You spoke about the toxic conversations around the braai vleis fires, where around these conversations, everybody is the victim. So the Afrikaners are the victim, or the whites are the victim, or the Indians, or the brown people, or the black people. What would your message be to these toxic conversations, or how to disarm them in a way as people who commit themselves to Christ, who needs to be the light and the salt out there? How do we change and transform those toxic conversations that is sort of South African?
Well, that's why I feel sad about these mega churches and even the non-mega churches like mine, where the church has lost its prophetic voice. The church has lost its way as the healer or the healing circle that need to be encouraging, supporting, and leading these conversations. Because when we do that with a supportive network, can transform toxicity into a healing balm. Now, it's not just the braai vleis toxicity. It is a kind of cheap talk you hear around township shibis, around where people are self-deprecating themselves, others, and it's all about, yeah, I can have that car, you know, he thinks it's better. Excuse me, that is so infantile. But we do regress to that infantile stage when we are not dealing with what's beating us up inside. Mm. I was using the metaphor earlier on with you about if you have a drunken alcoholic uncle, whenever people come into the house, you lock him up in the bedroom and give him his dope so he's quiet. You are very unhappy as a family. Whereas, the thing to do is let him come out, accept him as he is, or help him to go and drive. And some people won't drive. And believe you me, this is from experience in my own family. If they don't, you just accept them as they are. Don't lock them up. Because when you are trying to hide something that you are ashamed of, then you become the shame. And that person, alcoholic as he is, still a human being, still has dignity. And to the extent that you show them dignity, you are in fact helping in a small way towards their healing.
Ma, you've always spoken out for the poor. And it seems like a recurring theme in your conversations and your activism, as we cannot ignore the poor. And I want to lead you to your Germany. You referred to it briefly. Maybe just say a few words about that. But I would also want to ask you to maybe answer that question in a way that how can ordinary people, like there's no offense, but how can ordinary people tackle this issue? We are probably the most what's the word? Divided, unbalanced, unequal society in the world. This is strong on your heart. How do we change this? How do we begin to change it?
I think in the first place, I'm not speaking on behalf of poor people. I'm speaking about the condition that allows a rich country like this to have poor people.
Yeah.
And to challenge each and every one of us to change that situation. We have enough of everything in this country. Young people are complaining today about not having access to high quality education. You know how much it will cost to have free education from beginning to end? An additional 70 billion. Small matter of 70 billion in a 1 trillion plus budget. What's that? If we had the will, we'd do it. But we won't get the will unless we do this emotional settlement story, because now, you and I, our children go to good schools, they go to university. It's the problem of those people, it's the problem of your domestic worker, the gardener, and so on. It's not. It's yours and my problem. Because to the extent that they are not educated, they are not trained, they will be the people driving crime, driving despair, driving all of the negative things that we see in our country. Now, in our excitement post-1994, we fail to understand that our wonderful rainbow nation cannot stand without the accompaniment of an emotional settlement and socio-economic restructure. You can't build Tshwane as a white city and then come Somaso plugging the others on the peripheries of it and say we are a transformers. It's not going to happen. And it's not happening. The same thing with a whole lot of other things. So the lessons from Germany, we took lessons from Germany in terms of the federal system, proportional representation, but we fell short of taking the most important lesson from Germany, which was you too great a degree of inequality makes human community impossible. Helmut Kohl, who was a chancellor at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, Christian Democrat. He was not a radical man, but he understood, he was a smart man, he understood that to make Germany whole again, you will need to make sure that the child who grows up in East Germany has the same chances as the child who grows up in West Germany. And that's not going to happen because you give them scholarships to come to West German institutions. You just have to invest the money to reimagine and redevelop Germany as a unitary state. We didn't do that. But to do that, they recognize that they have to have extra budgets. And that extra budget has to come from people who stand to benefit. Because a united Germany is now the strongest European nation today. Their economy is the strongest. Why? Not because they are smarter than us or they work harder than us, but by creating an environment where everybody's talent is unleashed. So you don't have to all go to university and do BCom, but you can go to a training school which makes you into a master builder, master electrician, master. You get even more money than the professors at university. But you are there. So right now when we want to do something, we get German technicians. Because on the dom to breed them here. The Germans have tried through their embassies to help us with that. But because we have not made the emotional journey of healing. Now it's not just white people who didn't do the people who came from exile, they were wounded by the experience. Some of them left here as children, came back as broken men and women. Without that healing, we are not going to be able to see ourselves in the eyes of the other. That's the key. And for that, you need to not just talk about, oh, my brother. No. You can't say, oh, my brother, whilst you're having fillet and people are having to catch locusts to eat. We have the resources in this country. If we do it in a systematic way, you don't have to take away from anybody. But we are going to have to create pools of resources that we can share. Now, here's one of the ways I think the church can help. If each one of us were to say, from today on, our church is going to adopt an emotional settlement program where we have these conversations and go back to our homes, our workplaces, and we do what we need to come back and report, there will be problems. You will be rebuffed by people you're trying to reach out. Come and have further conversations with people so that we can find a way. But if all of us, imagine if there were these nodes of these wonderful conversations. There is something about a spirit like that that it permeates. The church didn't start as one huge mega church. It started with those 12, or there were 11, they added one person. And then a few people around. That's how it started. And Geku Lagos, today, so many centuries later, we are still a church because of that. So I believe that the lesson from Germany is that you need a political settlement, an emotional settlement, socio-economic restructuring resources that have to be released at different levels. And I was suggesting that instead of us paying this 1% of payroll into the theaters, where the money gets to build these beautiful buildings and no technicians or technologists emerge out of that, you as business people, NGOs, even the church, wherever you are, you can set up training programs and just simply send them a statement. This is what we did with our 1% of payrolls. Here are the qualified people. This is where they are employed. And so, finished club. We can do it. But by just saying, oh, what can I do? Plenty. That's my answer.
I'm not going to give you much of a chance to drink water, because I want to ask you about some of those examples that you've seen recently. You've told me about a dance academy. Maybe just share that with the group as well.
I live in Cape Town, and I live in Kent Bay, as I said. And 2 years ago, I went to a friend of mine's end-of-the-year party at her. She's got a clothing shop in Clermont. And there was this group of 5 or 6 young people from Khayelitsha were performing. Turns out that there are 5 out of 80 students, or out of 84 students who qualified that year. That was 2013. They finished their matric. Some of them really good pass marks. UCT can only take 4 students per year. The rest, back to the streets of Khayelitsha. Now, that's where nyaope comes in, that's where alcohol comes in, that's where tech comes in, that's where pregnancy comes in, all of them, okay? So instead of us saying, well, this government is really bad, why are they doing this? We decided, as 4 or 5 women, we went to contribute towards a pool of money, very small, 1,000 rand a person supporting another young person. And we then mobilized resources from the likes of Pick and Pay and others. We have 22 young people who have already graduated, 3 or 5, who are working as real consumer dancers. These young people have a dancing genre which is a combination of ballet and African dance. They are unbelievable, that's all I can say. And they work like mad. They ride the train from Khayelitsha into Pinelands, where we've got a place where they practice. And the woman who's teaching them is really volunteering. So all a combination of volunteers has come together, and we have recruited people to mentor these young people, because they tumble up. The mother of one of them, in fact, who's been buried today, was an alcoholic, and she's the only child. But how can she learn how to be who she should be as a woman? So we mentor them, we match them with people. That's a small thing that we have done, and it doesn't take more than, let's say, 2 hours a week for me. Now, imagine if each one of us were to find an appropriate example of what you can do. You could train chefs, you could train carpenters, you could train electricians, you could train office workers, you could train a whole range of people. And that, in my view, is an example of what is possible. In the meantime, we need to tackle the real source of the problem. We cannot and should never allow this failed education system to continue to fail young people. Young people have stood up. We need to be, you as a church, all of us collectively, need to be standing up to support these young people instead of them believing they can burn libraries to get things changed. No. They have said what they say should happen. We must stand up in support of them and say, yes, we can, if we want to, afford free education. The Germans get free education. The Finns get... Do you know that Finland was one of the poorest countries in Scandinavia? Today, they are the number one. Why? They decided one day in the 60s that enough is enough. No more you are a child of a logger, you grow up to be a logger. Now they have high tech, but they still have paper and pulp industry used now at a different level. We should do it. Because there's mineral wealth in this country. And when the prices go tanking, we don't have an answer because we have not run our mining industry like it should be run in the 21st century. Still like those old dopes of whenever. We can transform our socioeconomic structure if we realize that political settlement without an emotional settlement without a commitment to socioeconomic perspective is doomed. We will stay with this pedantic economic model. We will stay with this low productivity. We can enhance each and every business in this country. People were working together with the spirit of we are in this together. Imagine. Have you seen how Germans work? When the prices tank, the workers are the first at the board meeting to say, no increases, no bonuses. You don't have executive bonuses while you say to workers. And everybody chips in. And the economy continues to grow.
You can see there's a reason why the apartheid government banned her. She's quite the activist. When she gets going, it's hard to stop. I can see the judgment from you guys because you are not asking the questions. So I've got 500 questions here, but because I am the Christian that I am, I'm going to give you an opportunity. So maybe just put up your hand. All right, just don't be that aggressive. Let's go for Gior and then Yaku and then Harman. I'm going to leave this with you.
Hi, yeah, thank you for just the opportunity to ask. Is Europe really an option to look for as a solution? If I'm looking at Germany, which has been brought up a lot, I find that Europe is, in a lot of senses, post-Christian. And we're looking for human and economic solutions. And yes, education... We need that, and I also believe that's a Christian answer. But don't we need something more radical, especially from a Christian sense? And I think I've heard that. But shouldn't that be a lot something that we teach a lot deeper? If I can say something from C.S. Lewis, he said if you give someone an education, he just becomes a better thief, if he was a thief before that. So, and I'm afraid if we push for just economic... sustainability, we'll in any case lose everything because our morality must be rooted a lot deeper in our churches and in our faith. So I think the conversation is in the wrong sense. That's my question.
Let me take three and then I'll respond.
Thank you.
Dr. Rampele, my question is, I would like to link to your opening statement. You said, okay, my question is God in politics? If I look at the build-up to the local elections, and I look at the strife between the ANC and the DA and the EFF, and the fighting and the shouting, then I really wonder if God is in politics, because it seems to me that every politician is just there for either his own survival or to enrich himself. And in the end, those are the people that make the decisions in our country. Those are the people that make the laws and that govern us. So looking from outside, it looks like a fairly grim picture if I look at politics.
Hello, Dr. Rampele, thank you. My question is on, I agree with the emotional settlement and the socioeconomic restructuring, but it's very vague. And you mentioned the example of training the dancers. If you look at Tshwane, and you say Tshwane is geographically still in apartheid, and we need to address that, could you be specific about how you would, if you were the mayor or you had more power than the mayor, how would you restructure the city for prosperity and integration or whatever?
Okay, let's go back to the... you said the German model is not for us. We should be having more values-based engagement. I thought I started there. I said to you that what governs my life and what has always governed my life is the belief in the wisdom of Ubuntu. We've put Ubuntu in our constitution. So I'm not introducing it to something because I like it. We agreed to have it in our constitution. And what does it mean? It means that I see me in you and you see me in you. Now, when you do that, that's what our relationship is going to be, one that is governed by the values of empathy, human dignity, and mutual respect, etc., etc. So when I talk about the German model, that's the practical part of what you do. I mean, for us to admire each other and not have the works that go with it, it's not going to help us. So the Germans didn't wake up and just have a mechanical socioeconomic restructure. They sat down, they had these conversations, tough conversations about how do you get people who were brought up under a communist regime coming together with people who came either the way atheists or Christians or whatever, it doesn't matter, but they're all Germans. How do we develop a German value system that then unites us? And at the heart of what united them was the knowledge that too great a degree of inequality makes human community impossible. Now, when you proceed from that point of view, I can't find anything more Christian than that, anything more spiritual than that. So I believe that what I'm talking about is about values-based leadership, values-based citizenship, values-based engagement at the socioeconomic level. That's what I'm talking about. The question of, is God in politics, given the grim picture there, God is right in the middle of it. If you go back to the Old Testament, the children of Israel, if you thought there was a grim picture, just go back there. Right? But God didn't abandon them. That's why I started by saying we have a merciful God who forgives us over and over and over. And the issue of politics is not inherently grim and filthy. It is because the style of leadership, the philosophy of leadership, the framework of leadership is a dominant alpha male model, where you have to have a top dog and then the small dogs eat the little ones and so it goes. That's why you get this kind of cacophony. But if you listen to Solim Simang the other day, when he was inaugurated as mayor, you honestly have to agree that there was a man who was not about himself. It was about what he thought was possible about Tshwane and what he is going to do as a servant of the people to make Tshwane work for every person, including in the wars won by the ANC. And I think we really need to be grateful. We were grateful in 1996 when we settled. It wasn't a perfect settlement, but we celebrated it. I think this year we should celebrate the outcomes of this local election. This is historic stuff. You've never imagined that you'll have a Julius Malema agreeing to give his vote to the DA, noch al. But he is, because he's a smart man. You may not like his politics or his sayings and so on, but he is a smart man who realizes that there is something bigger than just Julius Malema. He may be waking up to it late in life, but he is. And so I think we need to take the change that is clearly in the air in our political space, celebrate it, and then go back and say, how do we make our ward work better? Do you know who's your ward councillor? Great. Get to know the person. Make sure that person does the work that's meant to be done. And go back to Msimang and take up his challenge to you as the people of Tshwane to say, if you want Tshwane to be this place, a city for all, a capital city that models a post-apartheid city, what would we need to do? And I heard him talk about some things, but practically, we need to reimagine Tshwane from scratch. We can't break down what's there, but we can have a different framework. When we look at empty spaces or derelict buildings in Tshwane, the first thing the tenderpreneurs think about is how they can develop it into a rich people's apartment blocks. Why can't we have a mixed residential space? Why can't we have mixed-use neighborhoods in our cities, not just in Tshwane, in Cape Town as well? I'm going to have a chat with Tani Dilil, Patricia, because she's going into a second term as mayor. What legacy is she leaving? What legacy is she going to leave in Cape Town? She can't leave Cape Town with Blekkersdorp or Khayelitsha with Porter Porters. She's got to rethink Cape Town. And it's not going to happen because she sits in her room, and she has to have conversations across the city, different age groups, different socioeconomic groups, and the business people in Cape Town must see this as a business opportunity. Imagine we have a country where 80% of the population is either unemployed or lowly paid or whatever. That's why our economy can't move. That's your customer base. That's your skills base, sitting there idle. I mean, trying to run a 747 with one engine is the height of lack of wisdom, which is what we are doing here. We have to acknowledge that for South Africa to move forward, we need to get all South African citizens working in a way that adds value to the economy, to the society, but also to the values and the culture of our country. We have fantastic cultural assets. in our diverse music, dance, and whatever. We are not leveraging them as much as we should. I mean, you go to Cape Town, I go to the City Hall. How can someone from Khayelitsha go and listen to a concert in the City Hall? It's on Nusa. You can't do that. So we need to think differently about how we can run our cities, reorganize them. We have the worst public transport system, I think, by far. And yet we have the technology, the knowledge, the resources to reimagine our cities. We don't do it. We can have rapid transport through trains and so on. Instead, we're going to buy trains with wrong gauges. So, you know, we really shoot ourselves in the foot. So when I talk about reimagining Tshwane or Joburg, or there are practical things. There is actually a report written by the African Development Bank, UNDP, and OECD about the African city. We are not unique, but we have more resources here than any African country. We can transform our metros now that we have this changing of the guard and really make them more livable and more vibrant. Okay. Shall we take a few more?
Did you? Yeah.
Is there one that I didn't answer?
Did you answer? Yeah. Okay. Let's see if we can take three more and maybe end with that.
Thank you, Doctor. I'd like to ask you to reflect over the past 20 years. We've had tremendous success with the ANC, but also terrible scandals and failures from the ANC. What can politicians, as well as non-politicians, learn from the past 20 years of democracy in reference to how the government was run?
What would your message be to school students and to university students? How should they imagine possibilities?
Doctor, why are people still voting for a corrupt leader?
Okay, is that it? Right. Well, the past 20 years, what are the lessons from the successes and the scandals? I think the most important lesson from the past 20 years is that you cannot build a house on sand, which is what we tried to do. Building a democracy without making sure that every citizen understands their rights, their responsibility. We are one of the few democracies that don't teach civic education in our school system. We don't teach it in our workplaces. We don't teach it in our churches. How do we expect people to be able to exercise their rights and responsibilities as citizens when they've never lived in a democracy, whether they are white or black or whatever? We all came new to the democracy. And this is a constitutional democracy, which means you actually have to understand the letter of the law and the place of the constitution within it. And yet you hear people say, well, we've got so much crime because capital punishment has been ended. Otherwise, people will stop killing. Well, they didn't stop when we had capital punishment. Why would they stop now? So we really have not invested enough in strengthening the foundations of our constitutional democracy. Going back to your practical things, first thing I think we as citizens must insist that civic education be taught in our schools. We've got something called life orientation, which is a free period, a scandal. That's the time when they should be doing this, so that young people get out of the school system, the university system, really understanding what it means to be a citizen of South Africa. Second, I believe that we also need to understand that the scandals that we see come from people who think it's now our turn to eat. because there were people who were eating before 1994. And we forget that sometimes. And so we need, I'm not saying it's right that they should do that, but we need to call it. That's why these emotional settlement talks are so important. To acknowledge that corruption didn't start with the ANC. I mean, I remember when we wrote Uprooting Poverty with Francis Wilson in 1989, there was the scandal of, literally, you could, as far as your eye could see, were toilets that were some tenderpreneur, booty has been given a tender to put toilets in the bush. Nothing happened. Those toilets, in the end, just crumbled. So we are not inventing scandals and corruption in South Africa. It's been there. It's not right. But if we acknowledge that we come from that, we need a new dispensation, because then we were not a democracy. Now we are, and we are a constitutional democracy, and we need to. But we have to come to the table together to have those conversations and to commit. We, as whatever company X that has, in fact, made money out of the migrant labor system, and now look at how much of a runaround mine workers are being given, with their ties and their disabilities. It's a scandal. And we as citizens here don't say anything. They have to get a lawyer to fight for them. We don't feel that actually that diminishes our humanity, that people die fighting for a small compensation for the damage that the old-fashioned mining industry or mining approach has left with them. So with that acknowledgement and an insistence by us as citizens to say we need to move forward, we can actually learn the lessons of the past. Not just the past 20 years, but the past as it reflects in the past 20 years. Because unfortunately, when you don't transform but transfer power, people do exactly the same that the other O was doing. Right? Now we need complete change in the mindset. What message, I think, let me take the last question. Why are people voting for corrupt leaders? They voted for corrupt leaders. All the history of South Africa. I mean, I take people back to the colonial history. You know, the guys who came here to conquer this country were pirates from the UK. And today they are called Earl Gloucesters, whatever it is. They are, one of them died the other day, worth £6 billion, owning half of London. How did that happen? Can't be hard work, right? So we inherited the whole colonial enterprise is a corrupt enterprise. The apartheid system was a corrupt. And then 1994, instead of us saying, hey, we are not doing cleaning of the front desk, we're doing spring cleaning. We didn't do spring cleaning. We found little de Kock and we put him out to hang, and the rest of us continued to feed at the trough. So we need to acknowledge that we need a new beginning. Now, the other reason which it took me a while to understand, I didn't understand it enough when I founded Ahang, how emotionally attached people are to the ANC. It's not Zuma they are voting for. It is the idea of the ANC as a party that they associate with fighting for freedom. They associate with Mandela, who's a saint in their minds. And that emotional attachment to the ANC, you're not going to knock it off because you've got a corrupt leader. You're going to knock it off by making sure that people are better educated, they are more able to see a future for themselves without the patronage of the ANC. The likes of Msimang, I don't think that he grew up without being attached to the ANC. But he opened his eyes, but he had a plan in his head about how he was going to become a different leader. So for as long as we don't do civic education in our school systems, in our workplaces, what reason is there that civic education is not part of human resource development in the companies of South Africa? What's the reason? Zero. What's the reason why civic education is not part of your training and development of your parishioners? Zero. But we just have this blind spot to matters civic. And without that, the quality of politics will descend to the lowest common denominator. And I'm very encouraged to see young people now being bolder and bolder at making different decisions. So we need to celebrate the little victories of this local election as signs that change is possible. Remember, no one imagined that we could have a Swani without it being under one party. No one imagined that the Nelson Mandela Bay could be under anybody else other than the ANC. And it's not just the ANC. I mean, in Cape Town, we have had the DA there for now more than ten years. But they too have not addressed the fundamental question of reimagining the city. So we have work to do, all of us, and I think we have to give people the alternative rather than voting for those that they feel they are they owe them their freedom. Message for students. Well, I'm very encouraged that students have finally stopped partying and start looking at the future. Because, quite frankly, after 2000, South African university students and technical students just checked out. But now they've checked in. We need to find ways, and that's where I think people like you in the business sector, in the professional sectors, we need to find ways of supporting the young student leaders who are really kind of, I don't know, kind of constructive politics that are not about burning or blocking about this, but just strengthening their voices as citizens. Many of them that I bump into actually don't understand how our political system works. It's only now that some of them are really going back to looking at, hey, how do we get involved here in a way that is constructive? So I'm very encouraged that there is another window of opportunity. Again, the church, there are lots of young people in the churches. If we can encourage them to think values-based leadership and to conduct themselves in the first place in that manner, and then engage with others in conversations that high education system in this country. Our education system is such a poor quality. So, what happened?